Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council holds its plenary assembly, listening to the hopes and expectations of members from different continents. And as Pope Benedict prepares to make a two-day visit to Spain, we take an in-depth look at the pilgrimage city of Santiago de Compostela. Only through charity, sustained by hope and illuminated by the light of faith and reason, can we achieve the goals of integral human freedom and universal justice. Those were the words of Pope Benedict XVI to members of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, who began a two-day plenary assembly on Thursday, looking at some of the key human rights challenges facing the Church on the different continents. Under the leadership of Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana, who took over as president of the council almost a year ago, members will reflect on ways in which the rich social teaching of the Church, contained in the annual Peace Day messages, the compendium, and above all the Pope's recent encyclicals, can be made more accessible and put to the service of local communities.
That's where Caritas in Veritate has opened new frontiers for us, because I think that the Holy Father clarified what exactly we as Church can contribute to these issues.
Jesuit Father Michael Cherney works at the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. He told me how the plenary will focus above all on listening to the wealth of local justice and peace experience brought by its members and consultors, while also aiming to draw up a vision for the coming years.
This is the first plenary since Cardinal Peter Turkson was named president of the council just over a year ago. And so the plenary doesn't have an announced theme. It is explicitly, deliberately, the first meeting with the members and consultors in order to begin the process of dialogue, in order to really, first of all, to thank them, but then to listen. What do they feel they have done and observed over the past years? And where do they think we're to go ahead? So we're, in a sense, there to listen.
Over the past year, as you say, since the Cardinal took over, he's been talking very much about Pope Benedict's most recent encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, and the way it applies to countries trying to emerge from the economic crisis. Is this issue of economic justice perhaps likely to be quite large on the agenda?
Well, I would put it that the encyclical will be large. Whether the economic justice of the encyclical is the primary thing, or whether we will be talking more generally about the way the Holy Father has laid out the issues, and especially, I would say, the manner of thinking. How do we think economic, political, environmental justice nowadays, with the background of the crisis, but also with the much more permanent background of globalization? And I think that in some ways the crisis marked the encyclical, but I wouldn't reduce it to that. And so I can't say that the economic dimension or necessarily the crisis itself will be on the agenda. Again, it will depend on the people around the table.
The Council, of course, maintains very much a global vision, bringing its members from across the different continents. And yet, as an African president of the Council, I imagine the Cardinal will be drawing quite largely on his justice, his past experience of justice and peace work in Ghana and throughout West Africa in particular.
That's right. He brings a vast pastoral experience, and he understands pastoral experience as embracing political, economic, environmental, and social issues. So in that sense, he himself has lived the integrity of Catholic social teaching as part of the preaching and living of the gospel. And I think he will continue to do that. I don't see how he could stop doing that. And so whether we will be talking about electoral issues, democracy and participation, which he played an important role in Ghana, or whether we'll be talking about environmental damage and resource exploitation, or whether we'll be talking about the tensions between peoples, tribes, races, faiths, or the other divisions that seem to bring us so much grief. Yes, his experience will be there, but I think what he himself will want to privilege is the experience of the consultors and members, because that is the richness of a plenary, that we can listen to people from all over the globe with vast experience, and many of them with many years of experience helping the council.
It is quite a challenge, isn't it, this question of keeping a universal, a global perspective on some of these issues, given that often questions of vital importance in one continent perhaps seem almost irrelevant to people in another continent.
Well, and that's why I think that we don't want to use that sense of universal, in that we say, well, the issue facing the world is, and everybody has to work on it. That maybe was an approach or a shortcoming years ago, where some people felt they could identify the issue and that they could rally everyone to work on the issue. And I don't think that we would say that today. We know that the issues differ, and that is part of what it means to be Catholic. Catholic doesn't mean uniformity, as you know very well. And so I don't think we want that kind of universality. What we do want is that human dignity, human rights, decent conditions, access to work, and so on, the usual list, but that those are real lists of real issues for real people in every corner of the world. And one of the things I think that scandalizes people is that there is such persistent and, in a sense, devastating poverty in some of the richest countries on earth. So to say that it's first world, third world, or that there's developed and underdeveloped, those are already becoming out-of-date clichés.
You talked about some of these priority areas. I mean, in a way, that was my next question. If you could perhaps draw up a list of what might be the main issues that you'll be focusing on.
It's not only the Cardinal's first plenary, it's my first plenary. So I go also with a kind of a tabula rasa. I'm very curious to hear how they will describe the reception or the non-reception of Caritas in Veritate. I will be very interested to hear if they have interesting experiences of using the compendium. I'll be interested to hear if they describe ways in which the annual New Year's message has served the people that they know, the people that they represent. Those are the things, I think, on which we can then build. And I know that the Cardinal very much wants us to be aware and very sensitive to the needs that people have in order to be able to live their faith and to live the social dimension of their faith. So maybe our concern will be a little bit less on the issues and maybe a bit more on the pedagogy and the communication.
One of the particular challenges is the way in which this vast array of social teaching on many of these important, crucial issues, the way in which it can be put, if you like, more at the service of the wider community within a political, economic context in the different countries. It's a huge challenge,
and I feel that that's where Caritas in Veritate has opened new frontiers for us, because I think that the Holy Father clarified what exactly we as church can contribute to these issues. If anyone was under the illusion that we were there to solve them, you won't think that after reading the encyclical. But it really does help to know what is it that we as church can contribute, and what are other actors to contribute, and what do we have to respect mutually around the table if we're going to move towards solutions. And I think that spirit of constructive collaboration, if that could be rendered more pedagogical, more accessible, and more practiced in all the corners of the globe, then the encyclical would be doing its good work.
You said more accessible. One of the topics that's being discussed in some of the other councils in the Curia at the moment is the question of language, the church using a language that ordinary people don't really understand anymore. Do you think this is a question that you should be looking at too in trying to make these valuable teachings more accessible?
To some extent, yes, because we should all be concerned about the reception. There's no point in being a messenger if what you want to transmit won't be received. On the other hand, once again, we are in the delicate area of subsidiarity, locality, and universality. We cannot pretend to write encyclicals for each and every situation. And so that the language will not be the language of your local issue or your local struggle, your local politics. In that sense, it would be wrong to go for a kind of direct populism, a kind of direct...
Dumbing down is the expression, isn't
it? Well, all right. So there will continue to be a certain level of generality, and some would say of abstraction. Otherwise, we can't speak. We would be paralyzed, as some people are, that the issues are so complex that they end up not being able to say anything. It would be a pity if the church became kind of paralyzed with that kind of concern or neurosis, you might say. But when an encyclical or a New Year's message reaches the local conference of bishops, what happens there? I ask myself if that isn't where the problems of translation, in the radical sense of the word, translation and communication aren't best discussed. And if we could help in general for bishops' conferences to feel that these messages were more theirs for their use and their application, maybe that's the best we could do. And then they in turn will do it for the different parts of their diocese or their country.
Finally, a personal question. You've come to this job quite recently from your experience in Africa with the Africa Jesuit AIDS Network. What perhaps are your hopes, your expectations for this new job that you're doing now?
Well, I'm, again, in the mood of the plenary. I would say I'm, first of all, in the listening mode, and it's probably too early to say what I can dare hope for. Secondly, I'm really here to help, and so it's not, as it was before, kind of setting the agenda, but helping with the agenda as it develops and evolves. And thirdly, I think we need to build on this, you might say, this point of departure, the great work that has been done. And I've mentioned the three things that I think are fundamental: Charitatis Veritate, the compendium, and the annual peace message. And I would hope that a year from now or 2 years from now, that I would have a better sense of how these different parts of our task, how they're moving along and how they're developing, and maybe what a fourth or a fifth one might be. Maybe there's something else also that's important to do and yet to be identified on the agenda.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Michael Czerny from the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. The northern Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela, famed as the burial place of the Apostle James, is preparing to welcome Pope Benedict, who starts a two-day visit to Spain on Saturday. After visiting the cathedral and celebrating Mass there, the Pope will then move on to Barcelona on Sunday, where he will preside over the consecration of the famous Holy Family Cathedral. While the city of Santiago de Compostela has been an important pilgrimage destination since the early Middle Ages, the number of people visiting the tomb of St. James has increased significantly over the past couple of decades, since Pope John Paul II travelled there in 1982 and again in 1989. Pope Benedict's pilgrimage to the city coincides with the Santiago de Compostela Holy Year, which occurs every time St. James's feast day on July the 25th falls on a Sunday.
In Spain, it's very much, if you're going to go on the pilgrimage, you might as well go in the Holy Year, because it's like it feels more authentic to do in the Holy Year.
Marian Marples is secretary of the London-based Confraternity of St. James, which publishes up-to-date guides and advice for pilgrims setting out on the Camino, or walk to Santiago. She talked to Lydia O'Kane about the origins of this ancient place of pilgrimage and the aims of the Confraternity itself.
In 1982, which was a holy year, about six people from England independently all contacted the French Société des Ermites Saint-Jacques in Paris and made their pilgrimages in a variety of ways. And the secretary, who was an extraordinary lady called Jeannine Varcollier, suggested to them that they all met together and founded their own confraternity in England. And happily, in 1983, a group of them, well, those six people did get together and had a meeting, called a public meeting, and that was the birth of the confraternity as we know it now.
The history of Santiago is so vast, but perhaps you could give just a broad outline of the history of the walk of Santiago de Compostela.
Well, part of the story is in biblical fact, and part of it is very much in tradition. And then when we come to modern times, we'll go back to fact again. The life of St. James the Great, whose shrine Santiago is found in the Gospels. He was a brother of John, son, and they were the sons of Zebedee. All the disciples were sent off after the after Pentecost to preach in different nations. And by tradition, James went to Spain. And although he was very unsuccessful in Spain, he returned to Jerusalem for the Council of Jerusalem. And after the Council of Jerusalem, as it says in the Gospels, he was beheaded by Herod. He had two disciples who then took his body to Jaffa and placed the body in a boat. And the two disciples accompanied the body, now in the realms of tradition again, to where it floated through the Mediterranean, out of the Straits of Gibraltar and up the west coast of Spain. And the body was actually returned to Spain as a place called Padron, placed on an ox cart, went for several days overland, 3 days overland, until the oxen would go no further, and the body was buried. So this is in 40, 50 years after the death of Christ. And then we have to jump to 821, something like that, when a hermit in Galicia, because that was the area in which the body had been buried, saw lights in the sky and heard heavenly music and scrabbled around and found a burial. He went to his bishop and said, "I found a burial, what shall I do?" And the bishop said, "Well, I think if nothing happens, if bad, in 3 days, you'll find that this is the body of St. James." And the body was declared to be the body of St. James. And almost immediately, a small chapel was built over it, and pilgrims started coming. And the heyday of the pilgrimage was the 11th and 12th century, when pilgrim numbers really began to expand, and the cathedral as we know it now was built. Obviously, with pilgrims coming, it developed in wealth and prosperity. There was a very charismatic archbishop, Helmires, in the 12th century, who did a bit of a sort of Peter Mandelson job on the place and kept promoting it, getting its status raised from a bishopric to an archbishopric, and got it in good odour with Rome. And pilgrims continued, of course, throughout the Middle Ages. At the time of the Reformation, numbers began to stop and slow down, but I don't think it ever ceased completely. Maybe some years there were only a few pilgrims arriving at the cathedral in Santiago, but in the early 1980s, late 1970s, a new priest was appointed to the little village of O Sobrero in the mountains on the border of Galicia, and he knew about the traditions of the pilgrimage. He researched them, and he was the first person to start waymarking the route. And as soon as there were waymarkings, and then there was a guide, and then the pilgrims started coming. And so the whole pilgrimage has been reborn in the last 30, 40 years.
Choosing a route, Marion, how does one go about that? Because there are different routes. So is it up to you to choose the route, or are you advised the best route to take?
The route that I've been describing, that the priest Elias Valinha researched in Waymark, is called the Camino Frances, because it comes from France. Of course, pilgrims came from all over Spain and from other countries as well. And when one's choosing these days, one can choose on the basis of when the weather's going to be good, whether it's going to be crowded or less crowded, how far it is. Many people, about half the total number of pilgrims, actually only ever do the last 100 kilometres, and that's usually the last 100 kilometres on that Camino Frances. But you can, of course, do the last 100 kilometres on the other routes as well. There are places to stay and so on, so I think it's really those same things of the availability of accommodation, waymarking and guidebooks. And if you've got those, then you've got a pilgrim route that people can follow.
Am I right in saying that you can do this pilgrimage, this walk, on foot or on bicycle, on different methods of doing it? Would I be right in saying that?
Yes, you can walk it, you can cycle it. Some people have done it on a penny farthing. You can go on horseback. If you're not able to walk for any reason, perhaps you're in a wheelchair, you can make it by wheelchair. Any means. And, of course, you can do it, of course, by car or by bus, by coach. But I'm afraid the walking pilgrims have a bit of a hierarchy of pilgrims, and the walking pilgrim is generally thought to be the most authentic. Other people say that, of course, if you're doing the pilgrimage with a good intention, with prayers in your heart, then you are a pilgrim however you travel.
Has the Camino changed over the years? I mean, for example, more people from a tourist perspective or even from another perspective, having been on the pilgrimage yourself and hearing other reports about it, has it changed?
The Camino Francés, well, obviously has changed very much because there's very much more accommodation available, and that allows very many different kinds of people to even attempt to do the pilgrimage. In the old days, in the early days of the pilgrimage, you got the sort of pioneers and very quite self-sufficient people who were able to cope with a few privations and hardships. I have to say now that it's a bit of a rite of passage for some young Spanish people, and people are generally more demanding in their requirements when travelling. A lot of people don't find they can cope very well with the long hours of walking or the basic meals or the sometimes lack of hot water in the accommodation for a nice hot shower at the end of the day.
Who goes on this pilgrimage? I mean, what type of person is it? All types, old, young?
It basically is open to anybody that has a sense of wanting to know more about the purpose of life, I think. There are very young children, babes in arms, go with their parents. Very elderly people who are, you know, actually quite heroic, I think, in their feats of endurance and walking through pain and difficulty. The main thing is that you have to want to do it, and you usually want to do it for a reason. It's quite interesting when I talk to people, I ask them perhaps which books they've read about it, how they've come to know about the pilgrimage, and then I say, you know, what made you decide now to do it? And they often say they want to give thanks for their own recovery from illness, the recovery of somebody else, or in memory of a parent who's died, all kinds of things. One of the best ones, I thought, was a son who'd been separated from his father at a very young age, and they had recently found each other. They were going to walk the Camino together to get to know each other again.
This pilgrimage, it's not just for Christians, is it?
Not at all. It's obviously the heart of it is a Christian pilgrimage, because you're going to the place where St. James, who was one of Christ's disciples, who was very close to Christ, particularly close to Christ, is buried. And you're going to a great cathedral, and the heart of your arrival is the pilgrim mass. But I think it's a very generous act of the cathedral in Santiago that says, well, we don't mind who comes, but provided you come with an open heart. And when we hope and we pray that your heart will be touched and something will be moved and changed within you. It's a great opportunity for all sorts of transformational experiences. And so many people come back and say, I think it was the best thing I've ever done, because they're just so overwhelmed by the sorts of experiences that they've had on the way, particularly the way that people relate to each other and are so kind and helpful to each other, which doesn't seem to happen in normal everyday life.
Perhaps you could talk about the Holy Year and what happens during a Holy Year.
Right, the Holy Years have been sort of in the tradition since the 12th century. They go in a cycle of 6 years, 5 years, 6 years, 11 years, and we're just about to start on the next 11-year cycle. The next Holy Year will be in 2021. In Spain, it's very much, if you're going to go on the pilgrimage, you might as well go in the Holy Year, because it's like it feels more authentic to do in the Holy Year. But the main visible sign of the Holy Year is the Holy Door. And there's a wonderful Holy Door at the Cathedral at Santiago, which is opened on the 31st of December at the end of the previous year, with the Archbishop knocking down the old wall and opening the door. And then again, at the end of the year, the door is bricked up during the service, and that door will then not open again. And part of the arriving in Santiago in the Holy Year is to enter the cathedral through that door. But of course, for the full benefits of having made the pilgrimage, you should also go to the Pilgrim Mass, make your confession. And if you want to have the certificate, the special Compostela certificate, you should have walked 100 kilometres or cycled or ridden your horse for at least 200 kilometres.
In essence, what makes it different? What makes Santiago de Compostela different? And what makes people want to go back there?
But I think the pilgrimage is different because it is there are so many facets to it. You find so many references to it in history, in art, in religion, in music, in poetry, in verse, in plays. It brings a huge amount of cultural streams together, if you like, and so therefore it attracts a huge number of people. And that's also kind of on the intellectual side. But why people keep on doing it, I think, is that they just want to recapture the experiences that they've had. And those experiences that they've had are to do with the opportunity to meet all kinds of different sorts of people, to learn perhaps not to be quite so judgmental about other people, because you judge people and then you have an experience which tells you that you were wrong in your initial judgment or assessment of this person. You also, the experience of doing the pilgrimage is that you're very free and liberated from the ordinary baggage, if you like, that we carry day to day. You've got space and time to think, and people who are perhaps undergoing some kind of bereavement or change in life or loss really value that time, that opportunity, just to think, well, what is my priority now? What should I be doing? And they learn from other people. They learn from times of quiet and solitude, times of prayer themselves. They get some guidelines, some pointers to what, you know, what they might do in the next part of their life. And in that way, life itself is the pilgrimage. And we all, into various degrees, build in that understanding of pilgrimage into the way we live our lives.
Finally, Marian, I wanted to ask you, or get your thoughts on the fact that Pope Benedict will be visiting Santiago de Compostela and the importance of his visit there.
I think there's various ways in which this will be an important visit. The Pope, I don't know whether you've noticed it, on his almost his favourite mitre, he has a scallop shell. The scallop shell is the emblem of the pilgrimage in general, but the Santiago pilgrimage in particular. And he always says that He is a pilgrim pope. He is wanting to have that sense of moving, of travelling on, of meeting and learning from encounters, not being fixed in the past. He has that sense of progress, and I think he has that sense of pilgrimage very much in him. And of course, the authorities, the cathedral authorities in Santiago, are hugely pleased that he's coming, because, you know, it encourages many, many more thousands of people to visit Santiago who would not otherwise have come. And that's all good for the tourist trade and for building up the people's knowledge of the cathedral and the lovely city of Santiago itself.
Thanks there to Marian Marples, secretary of the London-based Confraternity of St. James, talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. You can follow all the details on that two-day visit on our website, www.vaticanradio.org/English. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.